I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. The Kansas City Public Schools District is working its way to full accreditation, but a change to Missouri's performance reports replaced easy-to-read percentile scoring with colorful graphs. It left some wondering, where do we stand? Today, we'll ask why the state has changed its presentation of test scores for the fourth time, get an interpretation of these latest numbers, and ask if Kansas City parents should expect the district to receive full accreditation this year. Then, the right for women to vote was a landmark step toward equality 100 years ago. But decades after the monumental 19th Amendment, the struggle for equal rights continues. We'll trace the path towards women's equality as we get you up to date after this hour's news. Good morning and welcome to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. I'm Steve Kraske. Missouri revamped its annual school report cards to make it easier for parents to see how districts are doing. It may be having the opposite effect. KCUR has Ellie Moxley to help us figure it all out. Later, the struggles for women's rights that happened after women's suffrage. But first, you just heard it on KCUR. The U.S. House has voted on a nearly completely party-line vote to formally authorize the impeachment inquiry against President Trump. We'll have more news and more reaction to that later on this afternoon. Well, too confusing. That's what a lot of people are saying about the report cards the state of Missouri issues to grade public schools around the state. The state used to use a percentile score and give it out to each school. Score above 70 and you are eligible for full accreditation, which is a big issue for the Kansas City Public School District, hoping to regain full accreditation in the months to come. Now parents and administrators are left looking at color-coded bar graphs. The intention is to make clearer the true state of educational progress in a district. So which is it, too confusing or better information? We're going to talk about it now. With us, Ellie Moxley covers education for KCUR. Ellie, good to have you. Good morning.
Glad to be here this morning, Steve.
Well, the one thing that strikes me about trying to gauge progress in the Kansas City School District and others is just how much change there's been year after year after year. The assessment tests have changed. Now how the state measures a district's progress has changed. It's a lot for anybody to grasp. How do you see it?
You know, and it's totally true. I think you said that they were both too confusing and more information, and I think it's actually possible that both are true. I'm looking at one of the sample report cards now, and, you know, it's about 3 pages long. It has this really long key that you need to decipher it. It does give you more information than those old percentile scores, but at the same time, you know, those were a little easier for folks to understand.
Folks who are in a hurry and have kids and don't have time to do a lot of homework to figure all this stuff out.
Exactly. And I think the Department of Elementary and Secondary Education, we call them DESE in education speak, they wanted to make it a little bit easier for parents to get meaningful information about their schools. You know, most of our schools in the state, Steve, were, you know, getting a 90% APR score or above. And if most every school district is good, I think most of us would agree a 90% is a good measure. They were passing, they were scoring in the accredited range. You know, that doesn't tell us that much about how a district was doing. So the state decided to, they kept how they calculate APR the same, but they tried to give us more information. And honestly, I think a lot of parents are going to kind of have some overwhelm when they look at these.
Huh. Why has the state changed its tests so much? We're going to the test, the assessment test that students have to take each year, not once or twice, but 4 times the past 4 years.
Well, there's a lot of history here, and it basically comes down to, at one point, Missouri was signed on to the Common Core State Standards, which are a set of national expectations for kind of what kids are going to learn in each grade level. They were really popular in kind of the around 2012 or so. A lot of states adopted them. And then some states got cold feet. They said, you know, we don't want to be part of any kind of a national initiative to set standards. That's a local decision. It should happen at the state. So Missouri switched to the Missouri Learning Standards. But in the interim, you know, they went from having one test to another as these standards changed. And this was actually the first year that kids took the same math and English tests 2 years running. So a lot of educators were really excited that for the first time we'd have an apples to apples comparison. And now the report cards are more apples to rainbows.
Doesn't that make comparing the performance of a district from year to year, it's all but impossible, right, Ellie? And until now, you say there's been 2 years in a row of the same test.
Right. And, you know, there are general things that we can tell from each data set. You can't maybe compare scores directly to one to another. But, you know, districts have a lot of internal tracking now, too. You know, you hear a lot that kids are taking a lot of tests. It's not just those state tests in the springtime. They're also taking really frequent assessments, you know, in their schools and in their buildings so that schools can measure their progress absent this data from the state.
Well, what does someone like Superintendent Mark Bedell of the Kansas City School District say about all this change? It's got to be tough for somebody like him.
You know, I think he's frustrated. You know, KCPS has been sitting on the cusp of full accreditation for a couple of years now. They needed to show 2 years of progress in a row. They're still waiting for all the information that they need to be able to make that determination. They have not had their science scores on the science test released publicly. And if kids did well on those tests and made progress, then there's a chance that they could be, you know, in December asking the state board for full accreditation. Bedell's told me he's not going to go for it unless they definitely 100% hit that 70% mark. So I think he just wants some consistency because, as he said many times to me, regaining accreditation is not an ending. It's the beginning. Mm-hmm. It's the minimum bar. It's the bar that KCPS needs to get over so that they can keep doing the important work, which is closing the distance between how their students are doing on tests and how Missouri students are doing as a whole.
So just to be crystal here, we've got math and reading scores in, but we're waiting for science scores. When are they coming?
So the district at this point has some preliminary science scores that they're going over. When districts get their scores, they have to go through and basically clean up the data, make sure that, for example, kids who've left the district or are no longer in the district or, you know, that those things, to make sure that their special needs population has been counted accurately. So what they do is they get their data from the state, and then the state takes their data, looks over their revisions and corrections, and then a final score is released publicly. I don't have an exact date for that yet. It'll probably be late November.
Okay. So late November comes. Then at that point, will we know if the district will be eligible for full accreditation?
Yes and no. The way that you calculate APR is known. Districts know how to do this. They have their own data folks that are able to take all of their scores, plug them into essentially the workbook from DESE, and make that determination. But there's actually going to have to be a process where a district like KCPS has to ask the state to now calculate its APR score. So they're going to have to do that. They'll get their percentile score back at that point, and then they'll know for sure whether they are eligible to ask for accreditation.
We're talking with KCUR's Ellie Moxley about the test scores for the Kansas City, Missouri School District and every other district in the state. The state's using a new system now to report how a district is doing. We're trying to navigate through that here. You know, the other issue here that's been around for a while is, why is it that we're sitting here on the last day of October, going into November, we're waiting for science scores to come out later on this month? The students took these tests when, Ellie? In the springtime sometime.
March and April, generally.
March and April, okay. Why does it take, in this era of age of the internet and computers, why are we waiting 6, 8, 9 months to get these scores?
I think that's one of the questions that Superintendent Bedell and a lot of school administrators across the state have. You know,
and they've been asking it for years.
Right.
This has been
years. You know, honestly, I'll be a little surprised. I was a little surprised that the scores were ready in October this year. Last year, we got them February 1st. So, well, and when I say last year, I mean we got the scores from 2017. This year in 2018 or 2019 in I've messed up the dates. But we got basically the 2018 scores in 2019 last year, so earlier this year in February. So there has always been this kind of delay. It has to do with those new standards and assessments. Every time you have a new test, you have to go through this process where you establish cut scores, which is a really complicated way of basically saying, like, you have to decide what's a passing grade on the test. What what gets you full marks? What gets you partial marks? What gets you no marks, kind of thing. Okay. So, yeah.
So again, we have the reading and we have the math scores, and those scores would suggest the district is eligible now for full accreditation.
It's a complicated calculation. I think there's encouraging things in the scores. You know, KCPS is still behind what the state average is, but, you know, they're making progress. There's actually some interesting things on this new report card. Something the district has told me for a long time that they've been able to tell from their internal data is that when they get kids, and they often get kids who are already several grade levels behind, you know, they're fifth graders, but they're reading on a second grade level. And they have always been able to say, you know, if we get kids for about 2 years, we can catch them up. And now the state is actually showing that data on the report card to show that for urban students, KCPS is doing a good job of getting kids back up, caught back up. Their kids are actually growing faster than kids in a lot of school districts across the state. So they're making incredible progress, and they're really trying to close that gap on the state's expectations between where their students are scoring and where Missouri students as a whole are scoring.
Right. Well, if any of parents out there have questions about the way the state grades school districts and individual schools, and we're wondering what everybody thinks about this new scoring method, give us a shout. We'd be interested in hearing your thoughts on this. 816-235-2888 is our phone number, or you can tweet us at KCUR UpToDate. Okay, so what's the case again for this new way of reporting test results? Ellie, what's the argument there?
You know, we get a lot more data. I think one of the places that you're going to see this a lot is, you know, we used to have, let's talk about our suburban districts. You used to have a lot of districts that were, you know, getting a 98% or a 99%. And does that really tell you that much? Does it tell you if there's strengths or there's weaknesses or there's things that are really important to you? Not really. So this is going to give us a little bit more information about each individual school. It's going to really try to cut into, you know, what parents are able to access. I think the challenge is I'm not sure how many parents are looking for this much data. I think this data has always been available. You could get on the website. You could navigate through the data portal, which is a little complicated and takes a little bit of, you know, kind of finagling to figure out exactly what you're looking at there and what you're getting. But this information has been available in the past. This does put it front and center. I think the real argument against doing it this way is I think it's just really complicated, and we are trying to equip parents with better information about how to pick schools for their kids, but at the same time, we need to put it in a form that they understand. Like, I know what the state means when they say things like growth or progress, but I don't think those terms are really meaningful to the average person. Like, when I say that, do you know what I mean?
Well, I think I do, but maybe not. Yeah.
Exactly. And, yeah. And, you know, and I actually had this conversation with one of my fellow education reporters when we were looking at this data. Like, we were going back and forth with each other because we weren't sure if we knew. And we look at this stuff day in and day out. So if we're struggling, that means that, you know, your average parent really almost needs a guidebook to get through this.
Well, I was going to say, you attempted to offer a guide on your Twitter feed to help parents navigate all this. Your own, it's an 8-step process to get information on how your district or individual school is doing. I got to tell you, just from looking through your Twitter feed, navigating all this looked pretty complicated to me.
And honestly, that guide wasn't how to navigate the report card. It was how to navigate to the report card.
Okay.
It was just getting from the landing page that the link that the state put out took you to actually getting the information about your kid's school. It took about 8 or 9 clicks to do that, just to get from where you were sent to where you actually needed to be. And there wasn't a way to get there more directly.
So what are you hearing from parents and administrators, for that matter, about the way the state is presenting these numbers this year?
You know, I've had a lot of administrators tell me they're pretty frustrated. They really, really wanted to be able to make that apples to apples comparison this year to be able to say, hey, you know, the state's data is finally something that we can use and to inform our teaching practices and that kind of thing. And they got something that they're going to have to spend a lot of time talking about with parents to make it meaningful. I ran this by a couple of parents that I would say are pretty savvy, you know, folks that are really, really engaged in the education landscape here in Kansas City. And there were things they liked about it. They liked the emphasis on kind of looking at how much students were growing versus how many of them just passed the test, the right. more information. But at the same time, you know, they're looking at it and it took them a while to kind of figure out what it was that they were looking
yeah.
at.
Let's go to some phone calls. Speaking of parents, I think we have one here. Gloria from Kansas City, Missouri. Good morning.
Good morning. I question the use of percentiles. If what you're measuring has to be above the 70th percentile, that means 70% don't make the grade.
So
I'm not sure I'm hearing that. That's
yeah.
correct.
So the way it worked is the state would actually there was a point system and you would have to score points on individual components of it. Part of it is test scores. Part of it's attendance. Part of it is how well you're preparing kids to go to college or get jobs when they graduate. So you'd get all of these points in these different categories. And the number of points would vary from year to year. Some years it'd be 120. Some years it'd be 140. And then you'd take those points and you needed to get at least 70% of them. So it wouldn't necessarily mean that...
Oh, you weren't talking about percentile then.
Percent or percentile, I think, is what she's asking about.
They call these percentile scores, and to get them, you need 70% of the points that the state is making mm-hmm. available that year.
Do you see what I mean, though? When you use percentiles, that means everything below that 70 percentile, that is 70% that are not making the grade.
And Ellie is talking about the percentage of the percentile, Gloria, if I understand right.
I think that Steve said that correctly.
Does that help, Gloria?
All right.
Yeah, I know. It's tough.
On the Prairie Home Companion, they'd always say Lake Wobegon, where all the children are above average.
Right.
I mean, that's impossible. You know.
Yeah. Yes, it is.
Yeah. So anyway, thank you.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Gloria. Yeah. Let's move past all this confusion just for a moment and maybe cut to the bottom line based on what we know right now. Which area school districts, we're talking on the Missouri side now, are barely making the grade? Is there anyone, any district that seems to be hurting right now?
I mean, we know about Kansas City Public Schools. They've struggled for a long time. I think a lot of people are watching what's happening right now in Hickman Mills. It's another provisionally accredited district.
And, doesn't get nearly as much
and
attention.
And it doesn't get hardly any attention. And this is something that I spend a lot of time with. I think that, you know, I think we've seen a lot of, you know, just yesterday, the Kansas City Star put out a list of folks that are really influential in Kansas City. And Superintendent Mark Bedell made it. And I think that was absolutely the right call. And I think a lot of people would agree that they have a lot of confidence in his leadership. I think the challenge is that nobody pays attention to Hickman Mills. They're struggling financially because of some of the tax incentive projects that are going on in their district that mm-hmm. have really cut their budget and revenues. And, you know, they have all the same challenges as KCPS. They're educating essentially the same kids. And when I say essentially, in some cases there are. We have a lot of movement between our different Kansas City districts as well as our charter schools, especially among our poorest students.
Mm-hmm. What the other districts are soaring? Is there any districts that really stood out to you based on what you've seen?
Not necessarily stood out. I mean, I think we all know that there are a lot of really good districts. I was actually going to give a shout out to Blue Springs that is making some real strides in kind of their achievement. You know, it's really hard to keep raising the bar when the bar is already high, and that's actually something you see with a lot of these districts is some of them show that they're not making much growth or much progress, and it's just because their kids are already doing great.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, when you're able to even move that bar up higher, I think that that's really saying something. I think a place to look for a lot of these suburban districts that are, you know, have always traditionally done well is to look at subgroup achievement. That's a fancy way of saying how well are, you know, students of color and children with special needs doing. Districts that are able to move that needle, that's really significant.
I was going to say, on that score, the Kansas City district showed measurable progress and some good news there. You did a story on this, Ellie. What did that point out?
Right. So I talked about this a little bit already about, you know, how the district is doing a really good job of closing the gaps for mm-hmm. urban students, helping kids get caught up. We know that kids, you know, because of the circumstances of poverty, because of what's kind of happening at home, often come to school not necessarily ready to learn. It takes them time. They get behind. They move schools. And what we can actually show on the report card is something the district has been saying for a long time, which is that they're pretty good at getting kids caught up if they have them for a significant enough amount of time to kind of do that, which they say is about 2 years.
Okay. Well, as we get ready to wrap this up here a little bit, let's just walk through the timetable one more time. So you're expecting, again, everything is sort of fluid here, but that later in November, we should get the science scores for all these different districts and different schools, and that'll complete the scoring for the districts. And then at that point, if the Kansas City, Missouri district thinks that it is eligible for full accreditation, Superintendent Bledel will make an application to the state to regain full accreditation, which will be a sign that he thinks the district has earned it, right?
Right. So he has said to me that he's not going to go after accreditation unless that, you know, he definitely has his 70% of points.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think that's smart on his part, and I think that, you know, the earliest that would happen is December, but I think that's optimistic.
Okay, so early in December, and then we'll sort of see where we
are. I think we're going to be into 2020.
Okay, sounds good. Well, that's KCUR's education reporter, Ellie Moxley, walking us through how the state is scoring school districts and individual schools with this new set of graphs. And Ellie, thanks for walking us through it. We appreciate
it. Thanks, Steve. I'm sure some people might be a little more confused, but I'll take questions on Twitter today if you've got them.
There you go. And good luck to parents out there trying to navigate all this. Okay, time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk about the women's long march to the 19th Amendment, gaining the vote, and all the rights that remained unsettled even after that point back in 1920. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. My newsletter got a little shout out in 435 magazine recently. They seem to like what they see, and you will too after you subscribe to Kraske Off Mic. Go to kcur.org/Kraske and sign up. It's quick and easy. Again, just go to kcur.org/Kraske. Friday on the program, meet the New York college professor who went to North Carolina to teach ethics. It sounds like the setup to a joke, but it's not. We'll hear what he learned about bridging the partisan divide. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Women gained the right to vote in this country 100 years ago next year. It followed a Herculean struggle to get Congress to pass the measure, but in some ways, passage of the 19th Amendment to the Constitution marked only the beginning of another long struggle for women. Whether it's the right to sue for being paid less than a man, or attending Yale or Princeton, or even serving as full members of the military, women would have to wait for years, even decades, for those rights to roll along. Some might call that astonishing. Lisa McClendon is director of the Bremer Editing Center at the KU School of Journalism. Will be giving a talk on the KU campus on November 4th, that's Monday, about all this. This is part of KU's ongoing centennial celebration of the 19th Amendment. Lisa, it's nice to have you. Welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
I should point out that she joins us from the studios of Kansas Public Radio over in Lawrence. So when did states like Missouri and Kansas ratify this all-important 19th Amendment, Lisa?
Well, the 19th Amendment was approved in 1919. You know, it gets through Congress, and then the states individually have to ratify it. I'm proud to say that Kansas was the fourth state to ratify the 19th Amendment. In Kansas at the time, women already had the vote, and there were individual states before the 19th Amendment where women were allowed to vote. Sometimes it was full suffrage. Sometimes it was, you know, well, you can vote in local elections, mm-hmm. something like that. Missouri was the 11th state to ratify. So all of the ratification took place in between when it was passed in 1919 by Congress and then through 1920 when it hit the majority of state, you know, the ratification right. majority of states to get that done.
I'm really struck by the fact that Kansas was number four out of the gate. I read that a lot of the Western states signed off on this very early, and Kansas in those days, believe it or not, was a Western state. Why was that? What was the connection with being out West and being open to the idea of women's suffrage?
Well, a lot of the Western states were, I mean, like Wyoming was the first state to give women the right to vote, and they were the first state to have a female governor. You know, I think it's just more of that pioneer spirit, I guess you could say. Historians could delve into that a lot more deeply than I can. But interestingly enough, the first state to ratify it was Illinois. So it wasn't a Western state that was first. It may have, some of this may have had to do with legislative calendars and things like that.
Do you have any sense, just broadly speaking, how female voting changed the politics of the country? Any sense of that?
You know, not a ton at first. You know, more later. It's really very interesting to note, though, that while the 19th Amendment, and it's a really short amendment, it's two sentences long, that's it. And all it says is the right of citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex. Congress shall have power to enforce this article by appropriate legislation. That's it. That's all it says. But even though it says any state cannot abridge the right to vote on the basis of sex, lots of Southern states still had policies in place that were effectively keeping African Americans in particular, but other people of color, Native Americans, from voting. So women, while women got the right to vote, Black women in particular were still denied voting rights even after that because of other things like poll taxes, literacy tests, things like that.
I was going to say, even then, so even after this amendment is put into place, you said in 1920, right?
Yes.
Women lacked a lot of the basic rights that men had. On one level, you wouldn't think that would be the case. I mean, why didn't earning the right to vote, you know, end this matter once and for all, and women would have all the same rights as men?
Well, it just didn't. I mean, you would think that, oh, hey, we can vote now. It doesn't mean that women necessarily always vote in their best interest. Like, people today of all types don't necessarily vote in their own best interest. But also there were structures still in place that kept women out of things. Like, for example, you mentioned not being able to be admitted to Yale and Princeton. Some of the Ivy League colleges had accepted women long before that, but it wasn't until 1969 that Yale and Princeton let women in
study there. That's astonishing to me.
And some of the Ivies waited longer than that. Yeah. So my mother could not have gone to Yale or Princeton.
And what was the thinking?
Well, you know, I think it was just, you know, the tradition. It's men, you know, education's for men. You know, that long-term thinking. You know, some of it, the military stuff. After World War II, women were finally allowed to become full permanent members of the military. Before that, they could not serve as you know, full members, permanent members of the military. Even then, they couldn't do a lot of roles in the military. And it wasn't even until 2015 that women were allowed into every military role. So that's, you know, in the past 5 years.
I was really struck by that. It wasn't until 1948 when women are given full acceptance into the military. Mm-hmm. You would think that given the tensions and the needs of World War II to fund a massive fighting force, that the idea of women being allowed to come in during the war, there might have been some push to do that and get that done.
Oh, they were allowed in during the war. Mm-hmm. You know, the WACs and the WAVES were allowed in during the war, but then, oh, well, war's over. Go home. Raise your kids.
Okay.
You know, I mean, it was like, okay, you're a temporary member of the military. They were members of the military.
So we're talking full membership along in 1948.
You know, the permanent membership. Like, I don't have to get out of the military now that the war's over kind of membership.
Yeah. I think you've mentioned this one already. Until 1965, 45 years after the 19th Amendment was adopted, Black women did not effectively have full suffrage. It took the Voting Rights Act, Lyndon Johnson, right, to get that done.
Yes. Yeah, it did. And up until even after that, there had to be a Supreme Court decision saying that you cannot charge a poll tax. So even after the Voting Rights Act, which basically said, oh, you can't use poll taxes, literacy tests, anything else like that, that are, you know, they don't say anything about, you know, keeping Black people from voting. But that is why they were there. Mm-hmm. That was the purpose of those things, was to disenfranchise African-American voters. And so the Voting Rights Act got rid of that. And then, you know, they had to keep suing at the state level to, you know, get rid of some of those old Jim Crow provisions in there to make sure that everyone had full suffrage.
This one surprised me. Until 1974, married women couldn't get credit cards in their own names, and unmarried women sometimes couldn't even get them at all.
Yeah.
Why was
it? It was
1974.
Okay. Yeah. 1974, I know. I was alive.
Yeah,
then.
That's my lifetime. Yeah.
That's in my lifetime, I know. So, yes, again, like my mother couldn't have gone to Princeton and Yale. My mother couldn't get a credit card in her own name until she was well into adulthood.
And why was that?
And, you know, again, it's sort of like, well, you know, the man makes the money and, you know, he should sign off on his wife's credit card. And if a woman doesn't have a husband, well, how's she going to pay her bill? Mm-hmm. And, you know, and they didn't have to. It didn't mean that women couldn't get credit cards at all. I mean, it just meant that banks were allowed to deny them.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of this isn't like, oh, you can't. It's we don't have to let you.
Until 1977, women could be fired if they refused sexual advances at work.
Yep. 1977, yes. Like in the past 40 years, yes. So if you didn't, you know, if you refused the advances, they could sack you.
Until 1978, women could be fired just for being pregnant.
Just for being pregnant, yep.
Yeah.
We could, oh, sorry, you're pregnant. Goodbye. Now, this is kind of interesting, too, because there was an amendment in 1978 that added pregnancy, childbirth, or related medical conditions to Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, which was from 1964, to prevent discrimination.
Right.
But even today, even now, if a woman needs more time than the allotted maternity leave, if they need breaks during a work day to, say, pump breast milk or something like that, they can be fired still. There's not a protection in place there. There are certain rules at the, you know, federal level that cover big companies, but a lot of federal workplace rules don't apply to really small workplaces.
You know, I should point out that Lisa is going to be giving a talk about this Monday at 12:30 at the Watson Library over in Lawrence. You know, as you look back at all these things and these advances that took so long to fall into place, what should the takeaway be here? Is there an enduring lesson we should take away from all this?
I think the lesson is not to take rights for granted. The lesson is that you have to fight for rights, and sometimes you have to keep fighting for rights, that people aren't going to just give them to you out of the goodness of their heart a lot of times.
Mm-hmm.
And that's unfortunate. I mean, I'm not trying to make light of that. I just think that it's something that, you know, people sometimes don't really think about, like, oh, yeah, it's always been this way. Yeah, we always have this. Except, no, somebody had to fight for these rights. Somebody had to sue. Somebody had to complain. Somebody had to really push to get a lot of these rights. And, you know, we're still not there on certain things. And, you know, they're not just going to get handed to us on a platter. We're going to have to fight and push for them.
Well, Lisa McClendon is director of the Bremner Editing Center at the KU School of Journalism. And just for the record, my wife had John Bremner as a teacher and just to this day speaks glowingly of all the lessons he taught her. Just a legendary guy.
Yeah.
Lisa, thanks so much for your time. I appreciate it.
All right. Thank you for having me on.
Coming up, Brian McTavish and Spencer Hardwick with some fun stuff to do this weekend. Here comes your weekend to-do list. I like that. That sounds like the blues to me. Brian McTavish is here. He follows and writes about pop culture. With him, Spencer Hardwick, founder and curator of Wire KC Weekender. They're here with us each Thursday to talk about some fun stuff to do in your weekends. And take it away, Dr. McTavish. This is I like this music.
Joe Bonamassa.
Bonamassa.
If you're a fan of blazing blues rock guitar, and
he's going to bring it.
Steven Spencer, you're looking at one. He's going to bring it. Then you probably know about Joe Bonamassa. When he was just 12 years old, a lad, Bonamassa opened up in concert for legendary blues guitar man B.B. King.
Mm.
Not bad, huh?
At 12.
At
wow.
At 12.
Yeah.
But it wasn't too much after that that he became a blues-busting star in his own right. Okay, he's obviously, as you're hearing for yourself, got the technical facility on his axe.
Yes.
But he's got the passion. Because if you get up there with the guitar, you know, you got to make faces.
Mm-hmm.
And he makes a lot of
he
faces.
He makes a lot of faces.
Yeah, good faces. So get this. 11 of his last 15 solo albums, all released on an independent record label that he owns, 11 of his last 15 records have hit the number one spot on the Billboard Blues charts.
Wow, wow.
Here's what's interesting. I was reading that even though he sold millions of records over many years, he goes on these late night talk shows or the like, but he's not the spotlighted center stage guest. He gets to take a seat with the band, right? Because of that, I suspect that somewhere B.B. King is frowning and playing a sad note.
There you go.
On Lucille. Anyway, Bonamassa, totally,
Bonamassa, 8
totally
o'clock
headline
Saturday.
Talent. Wonderful guy.
Okay. Now for a wildly different slice of the cultural pie, I bring
Absolutely.
You Spencer Hardwick with his first choice here for the weekend.
Yeah, so this is for Dia de los Muertos at
yes.
the Day of the Dead at the Nelson Atkins
This
Museum.
Is not Joe Bonamassa.
No, not at all.
This is, this is something else.
Not yeah. exactly. So the yeah. music here you'll see is pretty upbeat, and people are probably saying, why are you doing such an upbeat tune for a Day of the Dead?
Yes.
Well, in Mexican culture, the Day of the Dead is not necessarily a day of sadness. It's to celebrate deceased family members, and that can be a celebration of who they were. And so the Nelson Atkins Museum is doing that through dance, music, artist demonstrations, and poetry readings. And I just have to say that the Nelson Atkins Museum lately has been on a roll. They've got 30 Americans. They've got a Muhammad Ali exhibit coming up
yes,
in the winter.
Yes, that's right.
But
the Tivoli Movie Theater. I
yes.
just went and saw my first film last weekend there. It's great.
It is fantastic. So Day of the Dead, November 3rd, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Nelson Atkins. It should be a treat.
What do we have here, Brian?
Okay, now.
This is interesting. New York Times does these kinds of events you're about to describe out in the city and out east, and they're going to do it something. They're not going to do it, but something similar is going to happen out here.
Yeah, yeah. It's like famous people with something to say. They get in front of people. And it's a moderated discussion. In this case, a little bit of Hollywood's coming to KC when John Cusack appears at 7:30 Friday night at the Arvis Bank Theater at the Midland. But actually, what comes on first at 7:30 Friday at the Arvis Bank Theater at the Midland is Cusack's breakout 1989 film, Say Anything.
Hmm.
So you watch Say Anything, and then he comes out and talks about the movie.
Wow.
There's this scene in Say Anything, the 1989 high school romance movie that Entertainment Weekly says is the 11th best high school romance movie ever.
Is that right?
I had no idea that there was a category like that. Anyway, there's this pivotal scene, classic scene. Even if you don't know the movie, maybe you've seen it in a clip somewhere.
It's been a long time.
Okay, where Cusack comes out and Say Anything, right? And he's trying to win the apple of his eye, Ione Skye. So he stands outside of her house while holding up this boombox, blasting the song we're listening to right now, their song, In Your Eyes, by Peter Gabriel. It was the movie that got the ball rolling for him. So
great song, great choice.
Oh yeah, he did High Fidelity, Gross Point Blank, Being John Malkovich, but this is the one that took him to where he needed to go. Check him out, hear what he has to say, pick a Hollywood star's brain, 7:30 Friday at the Midland.
Still some passing moments unforgettable. You twist to fit the mold that I am in.
What do we have here, Spencer?
So we've got the Sunday Art Lab. Now, Steve, you remember art class?
Not fondly.
Well, I do. For a lot of people, it was a time to really let out, enjoy their, really express themselves creatively. I know
it was
really
great for me. I couldn't draw a dog worth a hoot.
Yes, yes. So a lot of different things that you can make. So actually, it's the Kemper Museum of Art is bringing back art class through a Sunday art lab where you can drop in, and it's a creative experience. So there'll be different art materials. You can look at artwork. You can go through the museum's exhibit, read books, and there'll be different resources, sketching materials that you can design and create your own art.
Cool.
Reminds me of Kaleidoscope. I used to go to Kaleidoscope when I was a kid.
We used to do that.
It's
like
Kaleidoscope for adults. So I think it'd be a great way to unwind, something a little bit different on Sunday.
But this is at the Kemper, not the Nelson Atkins.
This is across
the
street at the Kemper Museum. Not to be outdone, the Kemper is also a fantastic resource for art.
No question about it.
How about finger painting? Steve, I bet you were good at that.
Get out of here. None of that. What do we have here?
Okay, let's do some jamming, shall we? It's the KC Mega Jam. I've never heard of anything like this. It's a single-song, all-ages, feel-good mob jam to promote local musical talent. All ages, all skill levels. You pre-register online if you're a musician. If you're a fan of local musicians, whether they're 9 years old or 90, you just show up and have a good time. Noon Saturday at Hy-Vee Arena. The goal is simply to bring together musicians from around the metro to show the abundance of musical talent here. They're planning a YouTube video. Maybe a recording will be released. Will it go viral? Who knows? But the more musicians who participate, the better, whether they're on guitar, bass, drums, vocals, keyboard, brass, strings, or what have you. Now, what will this mob jam be playing? I can't tell. It's a secret. It's part of the tease that organizers are employing to attract as large an audience as possible to come on down to Hy-Vee Arena noon on Saturday. It's a very famous song.
Where do you find these things?
I find them.
They're doing this to one song?
I told you.
Not doing to multiple songs, just one song?
Just one song. It's a moment.
It's this song right now.
No.
Oh, it's a different song.
No. It's a song that they don't want anyone to reveal except the participating musicians.
Yes.
How do you like
that?
Yeah. Huh? Okay, my lips are sealed.
Okay.
Sealed.
And finally today.
He did the Monster Mash.
The Monster Mash.
It was a graveyard smash.
He did the mash.
It got on in a flash.
He did the mash.
He did the monster mash. From my laboratory in the castle east to the master bedroom where the vampires feast. The ghouls all came from their humble abode to get a jolt from my electrode.
They did the mash.
Spencer, take us out. What do you got here?
Absolutely. So I Googled what would be the best song for Halloween. I thought it would be Thriller, but the Monster Mash came up. So big blast from the past. So classic songs, classic fall beverage is also wine. So come on down to the Wicked Wine Festival, Saturday, 3 p.m. to 6 p.m., Kansas City Power and Light. It's going to be live music, wine tastings, and small plates. Even if you're not a wine drinker like me, there's something for everybody to do down there. 21 and up, though.
21 and up. This is down in the Power and Light District.
Absolutely. All benefits will go towards the children's place.
Saturday from 3 to 6 p.m., right?
Yep.
Okay, that's Spencer Hardwick and Brian McTavish with fun stuff to do this weekend. It's going to be a good weekend.
Oh, yeah.
It's going to get warmer, too.
Well,
makes
look,
it even better.
Look, I just think that anytime we can play Bobby, Boris, Pickett, and the Crypt Kickers, we should do so. To have to do it only once a year, I'll take it. Thank you, Spencer.
And then afterwards, get a glass of wine. Thank you.
Glug.
Tomorrow, The Life and Legacy of Harry Houdini. It's Joe Posnanski's new book. We'll be talking to Joe about it and how his magic has endured nearly a century after his death. You can find and follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. You can follow me at Steve Kraske, and don't forget to like KCUR on Facebook. This program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Jamie Hobbs. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.